True crime today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for what?
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any breaking episodes and discussions on this case. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. In just a few moments, we are going to be talking with our guest, Dr. John Della Torre. He's a licensed psychologist. We're going to dive deep into the psychology of a killer, of possibly Brian Koberger, but also the community and how a community heals or even begins to heal from something so senseless as what as to what went on in Moscow, Idaho. But before we get to that, I wanted to play back for you a little bit of audio that Chris Cuomo had on his show just the other night. He was speaking with Brian Koberger's public defender, the public defender that was defending him while he was in Pennsylvania, specifically about his demeanor. I found it kind of interesting to get a perspective as to initially when caught with all this mounting evidence coming up against him and guilt looking more and more likely, what was he acting like? This is the account that was discussed just the other night between Chris Cuomo and the public defender, Jason LaBar.
The man is an intelligent man, Brian. He was easy to talk to. He was aware of the situation. Really, it was a great conversation that we had given the circumstances of everything involved. I believe he was shocked by the moment that the police broke his door down, had guns in his face. He was unaware that that was going to happen, and he was really shocked by the arrest. He wasn't expecting it, obviously.
And if you remember at this time, this is when a statement was made. It was drafted with LaBar and Koberger, stating that he believed he would be exonerated. Koberger, of course, speaking to that moment. This is Jason LaBar.
He said he was eager to be exonerated, which I believed him to mean that he believed he was innocent. I wasn't judging the case at that point in time. I didn't have the affidavit of probable cause. I knew none of the facts, and I didn't ask Brian about any of the facts or circumstances surrounding the case either.
Since that time, Jason LaBar, again, he was the public defender for Brian Koberger while in Pennsylvania, where the initial arrest took place. Chris Cuomo on News Nation the other night pressed him as to what he felt now that he's been able to read the arrest affidavit and other materials that have since come forth.
I said from the beginning, I read it four times through before I think I got most of it soaked in. I felt that it was a strong circumstantial case that's likely to possibly get stronger based upon other evidence that I would expect. But there are certainly holes. Whether or not the prosecution can close those holes is another story for another day.
Chris Cuomo also asking about, if you remember at that moment in time, reports are coming out that Koberger had said to police, was anyone else arrested?
That's my understanding of what's out there. When I spoke to Brian about what he said to the police, and he did speak to police for approximately 5 to 15 minutes before invoking his Miranda rights, he couldn't recall what he had actually said to them.
That's pieces of the interview that Chris Cuomo had the other night on News Nation. You can go to newsnationnow.com if you want to review more of that interview in its entirety. Let's shift the discussion over to the psychology of this case, not just the psychology of a killer. We've been talking a lot about that, but how about the community? How does a community that was so peaceful, so loving, so just non-threatening, that's really what you think of when you think of a town like this, 25,000 people in the mountains, haven't seen a homicide since 2015, I believe. How does a community like that begin to heal, begin to pick up the pieces, and begin to kind of go back to the way, the feel, the life that they once knew. Dr. John Delatorre, he is a licensed psychologist, is joining us to discuss just that. And I'm going to throw that question right at you. How does a community begin to heal from something like this?
Well, it's a difficult thing because in larger communities, like big cities, it's really difficult. But in smaller communities, it's certainly one of those things where they can become more insulated, right? Where they really look to each other as a community. And I always believe that groups heal each other, right? So the more connections that you have as an individual, the more ways in which you can relate to someone else and express and discuss those things with individuals who can understand and empathize and who have similar kinds of processes as you do, that it really goes a long way in overall positive post-traumatic growth. Because all life is trauma. Right, all life is trauma. Sure. Anything that we experience is going to be a trauma, and it's really about how we are interpreting all of that information. How are we processing that information? How are we integrating everything that's going on into our own personal beings? That if we view it as a negative thing, if we view it as something that is harmful to us, then that's what it's going to do. It's going to harm us. If we view it as an obstacle to overcome, if we view it as an opportunity for self-reflection and self-growth, if we view it as an opportunity to sort of reconnect to other people because we've been so isolated. And we've been isolated, right? Because of the pandemic, we've had to experience an isolation that we haven't had to experience since the 20s. Mm-hmm. So if we're thinking about how this is going to go long-term, what we can see is that as a community decides how it's going to move forward. Now, it doesn't have to necessarily move forward. It can move left, right, up, down, right? It can move any way that it wants to do. But if it wants to overcome obstacles, if it wants to decide that it won't be defined by the tragedy that has occurred, we have to then start accepting some of the traditions that are commonly associated with that area. Parades or, right, school is starting, right? So those kinds of things, celebrating all that we have and acknowledging those things that we lost without it triggering downside depression kinds of things, letting the feeling happen without it weighing us down.
Recognizing it, but not giving in to the negativity, essentially, which would be incredibly difficult. Especially if you're a resident of Moscow, Idaho, or just even in that general area or connected to the families or the victims in any way, shape, or form, even if you have a student that's going there, when it looks like something like this, that is, you know, so senseless. One, I'm sure, is grasping for, they're trying to find answers when there really isn't going to be a sensible answer. Will we end up finding out more about Koberger and maybe the psychology of what he was thinking and why he did it, motive in terms of that action? Sure, but it still will never make sense to anyone because it's a very twisted way of thinking. And it was essentially, for lack of a better term, a broken brain of one that would be able to carry something like this out. When something is so senseless, what would you say to someone when you know that there's no way to make sense of this, but to find some sort of peace or resolution to move forward?
Yeah, in therapy with me, that's a pretty common thing, right? It's a pretty common question. Why did this happen to me? Why did this happen at all? Right? I'll usually respond with, is there an answer that I could give that would make any sense to you? Because the truth is that there isn't. There's going to be all different kinds of experts claiming all different kinds of things about who this guy was. And the truth is, we don't know who this guy was. We don't know. The only person that can tell us who he is himself. And even then, is it possible that he doesn't even understand himself? Absolutely, it's possible that he doesn't understand himself. If we're looking for meaning, we are not going to find it in the external. We're not going to find meaning behind whatever incident has occurred. We're never going to find it in the external. We're never going to find it in the world around us. Meaning only comes from within us, right? We establish meaning for whatever it is that we are going through, whatever obstacles that we have faced, whatever tragedies we have faced. So if we're looking for meaning from some outside expert, from some outside source, nothing is ever going to make sense. And even if we did hear something that could potentially make sense, will we accept it as being reality? Will we accept it as being true? That's still hard to imagine. So what we have to do is take that step back, start thinking about when we view this action, when we view this act, when we view it from a distance, from a space, from arm's length, when we view it, what sense do we make of it in terms of how is it impacting me? How is it impacting how I'm interacting with my family? Is this now an opportunity for me to reconnecting, reestablishing, having healthy relationships with people? Now understanding that maybe some of these interactions that I've had with individuals that I thought weren't quite right, maybe I should have said something or done something a little bit more. Let me take an opportunity for positive self-growth. Meaning only comes from within. And if we're looking for something on the outside, it's never going to make sense to us. Or it'll never be accepted by us.
I'm curious to hear your opinion about isolation. Obviously, we've come out of a pandemic. There was a lot of isolation that was there. Some individuals, though, they've already been self-isolating for many, many years without a pandemic. Koberger seems to be one of them to a certain extent of what we know, very introverted. And not all introverts obviously turn out to be killers. I'm an introvert myself. I actually somewhat enjoyed the pandemic because, sure. Hey, everybody else is doing what I normally do. I kind of keep to myself. But in some cases, that is a very, unhealthy thing, and seems that it can lead to many other dangers or many other paths that one may go down because of that isolation. Do you think, in your opinion, did the isolation of that have any effect on Koberger playing out something like this to this extreme and pulling, and I'm not trying to make a pun here because it wasn't a gun, but pulling the trigger on doing something like this, at 28, where he seemed to have most of his life being rejected by women because of his awkwardness in a social situation?
Well, in some ways, yes. I mean, this is going to be a very long-winded answer to kind of go through this question. What I'm going to say in terms of isolation is that isolation over time is very bad. Isolation, as humans, we require connectivity, but there's a nuance to that connectivity because we need two different kinds. We need interpersonal, right? We need connectivity between other people, but more importantly, we need connectivity within ourselves. We need to understand ourselves. The better we understand ourselves, the better we understand other people, and vice versa. The better we understand other people, the better we understand ourselves. The pandemic was a forced choice. People like introverts and other kinds of individuals who don't require the energy that an extrovert requires in terms of gathering the psychological energy from other people. Introverts don't require that. And so when a forced choice happens of being isolated, it's simply they simply go back through all of the coping resources that they had developed over time. What we see with someone like Brian Koberger, what we hear about how he was sort of interpersonally, we have an individual who very much struggled with that interpersonal connectivity. And because of that, he likely had intrapersonal connectivity problems. A forced choice isolation can certainly impact someone's social skills. If we're not capable of interacting well with other people, and then we're forced to try to interact with other people through a screen, then we can no longer expect people to have positive decorum, to have these kinds of skills necessary for real world social interactions, because they haven't had the practice. They haven't been able to do that. And so it's certainly possible that the pandemic itself created a situation where had he been able to learn from, you know, negative interactions, to learn how those things went, that maybe this wouldn't have happened. But the truth is, it didn't have to happen. He chose for it to happen, and it didn't matter that he had experienced a pandemic. It didn't matter that he didn't have well connections, because a lot of people don't have those kinds of things. All of us experienced the pandemic. He chose to engage in these behaviors. He didn't have to. He made the choice. So nothing else really kind of mattered.
Sure. With someone like that, and yes, obviously he chose to make that decision. And we're talking a little bit earlier about inter and intrapersonal relationships and having that connection. What about individuals, and it seems Koberger might be one of them, where they're seemingly incapable of feeling. The empathy is not there. They have to essentially mimic others to make it appear on the outside that they're in step with the majority of human beings in terms of empathy and normal, healthy human interactions. When someone recognizes something like that, especially in a child, because I can guarantee there's a lot of parents out there that are probably watching this case and going, oh my God, my son or my nephew or somebody kind of reminds me of this type of character. Not necessarily that they're going to go out and stab a bunch of college kids, but the isolation, the awkwardness, the seeming to not quite understand, you know, a joke at the family get together, or just how to react appropriately in social situations. What do you say to parents out there who are sitting there kind of feeling that way, a little bit concerned about the children that they love, that seem to have some sort of disconnect going on?
You know, I have a lot of thoughts. And my first thought is going to this kind of concept. And it's a little bit sort of ancillary to this, but psychologists have always wrestled with the idea of, can treatment work with someone with antisocial personality disorder? Mm-hmm. Because the idea of psychological treatment is that we are developing empathy towards ourselves and empathy towards other people. If antisocial personality disorder individuals don't have that ability, and we're training them as part of therapy to have that ability, aren't we just creating more manipulative individuals with antisocial personality disorder? And here's my pushback on some of that, which is going to be, I want us to go back to some of the AA kinds of things, which is we fake it till we make it. Yep. And it's true throughout our development that we don't understand. We don't have words for some of the emotions that we have. So we have to learn from other people how to manage those emotions. We learn from our parents. We learn from our primary caregivers how to react in situations where, wow, I'm feeling overwhelmed or I'm feeling angry. Are we viewing our primary caregivers when they seem to feel the same way? Are they reacting poorly? Do they react poorly to us? And when are they reacting poorly to us? How are we feeling? To parents who are concerned that they might have a child like this, how do you feel around your children? Individuals similar to Brian Koberger and Nicholas Cruz, and we could go on, you know, James, well, we could go down the list. You feel weird around them. You don't feel comfortable around them. You feel like they are trying to take something from you, or they're trying to manipulate you. There is a feeling that is associated with it. That's not necessarily the case with a lot of these kids. And we have to remember, a lot of these kids are growing up in front of screen. They're not growing up the way that, you know, 90s, 80s, 70s kids that grew up, you know, going outside and interacting with other people. That's not the world that kids these days grow up in. So we cannot expect them to have similar kinds of social skills the way that we had and generations before. So we have to take all of those things into consideration. If you are someone who is authentic and you're able to have positive communications, it's okay if it's awkward, but as long as it's positive and you're listening to what your child is going through, acknowledging that they might feel totally and completely alone. And you know what? That's normal, because you felt that way 20, 30 years ago as well. Put yourself in your kid's shoes, see the world the way that they see it. And what you're going to find is that that kid isn't like that. They're just going through the developmental process. There are some other individuals, though, that you can feel that there's something wrong going on with them. And at that point, you need professional intervention.
Dr. John Della Torre, psychologist, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to talk more with John later in the day on another episode of the program. We're going to dive deeper into the topic of empathy, something that I think a lot of us are staring at our televisions, seeing Koberger and seeing another case, Brian Walsh and the Anna Walsh case, just utter lack of empathy, almost as if it doesn't exist within them to feel it. And how does one get there? Is it something that can be learned? We're going to ask John more about that a little bit later in the day. So be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss that episode or any of our breaking updates that we have for you right here on this channel. My name is Tony Burski. You can follow me online at Tony B Pod on Twitter. And if you'd like to get a commercial-free experience of the show, you can do that through Apple Podcasts when you subscribe there. Until next time, for all of us at True Crime Today, thanks for listening.